asking why, which is really interesting, right? You stop asking why, like, why this, or what is the point, or, you know, all you start asking is like, okay, like, I'm noticing that this crease only goes like halfway across this other line that I drew, or like proportionate to the paper. So you're focused more on relationships and less about breaking things up, right? And the effect is that you can sit in front of a cloth for an hour and a half and just draw it without being like, why am I doing this? Or like, what is the point? Because you're just so involved in it, right? And that's what I get out of, because I like, you know, I'm like, not, I'm an adult. I have early memories. I have memories from a long time ago, I would consider. And there is a certain pleasure in presenting those memories to yourself. You know, we use the word intimate. They're our memories or something. We're always gesturing towards something that gives them value. When you put yourself in that R mode, when you can draw, you are presented just with the value of the thing itself. You can kind of pay homage to it by drawing it. And I think Bukowski has, like any good artist who has realized that you have to think differently, Bukowski has tapped into writing this memory in this way without scrutinizing it for its like utility or anything, but it's just kind of paying homage to it and really being responsible to the value that he feels to it, and finding a form, you know, a very plain and simple form that reflects the value he feels in it. But I did just want to bring up, like, this is, because I can go into the next poem that I have as well, but I just wanted to bring up Betty Edwards, because I found Betty Edwards just in like a free book pile. And when I read it, I was like, this is a philosophical text. Like, she's quoting people, and like, she quotes like Krishnamurti in the margins and stuff. Like, she really thinks that she's doing something philosophical. Like, I think she's just teaching people to draw, but she's drawing on philosophical resources to do it. And some of the philosophers that I've seen would be really sympathetic to seeing this as like, oh, this is like a philosophical practice.
Well, and it's like any that's kind of the funny thing. I'm thinking about some of the other, I've got a couple of them very short quotes, really passages from other philosophers discussing this very specific issue. But there's always been this kind of divide in a philosophy where, you know, there's the world of figuring things out, the kind of like more analytic realm, and all the analysis involved in that. But then there's been the people who are much more sympathetic philosophers. Generally, we kind of put them more in the more phenomenological continental school. Obviously, it's way more complicated than that. So this is like, that's a horrible divide. Like, our listeners don't quote me on that. But the point is like, what Betty Edwards is talking about here, I think, is trying to get at, and I think the drawing example is actually fantastic, is that like, activity when done in a pure and effective matter is very simple and present. Like you are not thinking, you're doing, like you're living it out, right? You're not thinking, the painter, for example, you know, the great painter, whoever. I remember watching actually a little documentary with one of my favorite, more recent painters, who was a guy named Matthew Wong, a Canadian painter. I watched a little short documentary, some interviews with him, and him discussing like his work and his method, and he talked a lot about just kind of being present. And when you're actually painting, like, it's just like, he's not really thinking at the same time. Like, we talked about that kind of flow state earlier. Like, he's just kind of like doing the stuff, and it's kind of like coming out of you, and you just kind of get engrossed in the process. And just like Betty Edwards is kind of talking about there, like, if you're constantly in the background picking apart what this activity is, like the metaphysics of the activity and the functionality of this activity, the efficiency of this activity, right, the best way to do it, you will not be doing that activity. You are lost in the realm of some higher thinking, and you might think that it's better because it seems more complicated in your head, but you are just completely undercutting the process of living it out. And just like you kind of talk about Bukowski, his, you know, his own artistic way of just displaying this simple memory, displaying really a recollection of a very simple, banal thing, the way to capture that is to keep it simple, like keep it simple, stupid, for lack of a better way to say it, right? Like, you know, and it reminds me, like, I brought a little bit to a little short passage I'll read from Descartes, actually, of all people. Kind of illustrates this a little bit. Descartes said from his Meditations, Wittgenstein's Meditations, discussing his cogito ergo sum, and he says, and when I said the proposition, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum, is the first and most certain of all to occur to anyone who philosophizes in an orderly way, I did not in saying that deny that one must first know what thought, existence, and certainty are. But when these are very simple notions, the ones which on their own provide us with no knowledge of anything that exists, I did not think they needed to be listed. So basically, the basic concepts that go into Kierkegaard, immediately one of the criticisms, even at the time, and since, was, well, you know, like, you talk about this being the most fundamental and the most basic, but this whole thing involves concepts that are already, like, that you haven't elucidated. The thing is that, like, and Descartes basically passing them over and saying, well, those concepts are so simple that, like, you already know them. It doesn't matter. And on some level, he is actually right. Like, you know, like, that's a criticism towards him. And I think on some level, the point is, like, we do already have these, you know, we already have these, like, when you say, like, we talk about existence, or we talk about, sort of trade anyone who philosophizes the way that reverse another thought. So, like, things like thought and existence and certainty, you know, like, these are all intuitive initially to most people, to all everyone, I would think. And therefore, like, on some level, he is actually correct. Like, elucidating them isn't that necessary. However, the flip side of this we get into is that the simple is often more interesting or has more depth than we realize. Again, going back to the Charles Bukowski passage there, like, just kind of saying, there's actually a lot. It's a very simple memory. It's a very simple childhood recollection. It's very simply written with simple, plain language. But it's also got a lot of depth. And the same thing with all sorts of other writings and poetry and songs and art and all this kind of stuff, where it's like, yes, like, you can see these things, but there's also a way of experiencing them and understanding them and coming into contact with them that has a lot of depth, while not necessarily at the same time becoming over-analyzation of that thing. Maybe to follow it up, I actually have another from someone very different than Descartes, Kierkegaard, basically to make this point in a much more eloquent way. Kierkegaard on this topic said, the more the wise person thinks about the simple, that there can be any question of longer preoccupation with, it already shows that it is not so easy after all, the more difficult it becomes for him. So let me reread that. The more the wise person thinks about the simple, the more difficult it becomes for him. And then in parentheses he says, that there can be any question of a longer preoccupation with it already shows that it is not so easy after all. So, you know, again, it's like you, but again, I think the tension that we're talking about in part comes in here, where it's like, Kierkegaard's right, like, the simplest things, we might talk a little bit, but, like, the most obvious example to me that comes up is, okay, well, if we want to talk about the simplest concepts, we talk about being, existence, what is, you know, that kind of predication that all things that are already and always have been have, like, they are this entity, they have to, you know, whatever it is, right? The fundamentalist, but it's the most, you know, it's the most basic, and it's the thing that from people from, like, Heidegger to Wittgenstein to Plato to whoever are constantly, in many ways, grasping with and struggling with. There's a lot there, but also encountering it requires this delicate dance of not like going deep in the right way, which is more of that kind of, I think, like artistic encounter, for lack of a better word. Maybe you can articulate this extremely difficult challenge too. This is better than I can.
Well, I think in terms of the philosophical kind of fundamental, this is interesting too, because I think we can, doing analysis, I think we can split this up in two as well. You know, the analytic, for lack of a better, not the tradition, but so much so like the process of analyzing something, you can break it into its more fundamental parts. And eventually you do get to, like, you know, what Heidegger calls the most general concept, being. And then still with, you know, a more like continental bent or something like that, a more phenomenological bent, you can get to being not just as like the most general principle, you know, the most general term, but in the way that Heidegger would understand it as, you know, essentially one's relationship with the world and whatnot. But even still, because that's the philosophical conception, which we can break up into two things. But both philosophical conceptions still, I think, overdetermine what they mean by simple. Because in the way that Bukowski and the poets, and I'll talk about another poet here soon, understand simple, like, you know, a memory of being underneath a table when you were really young, like what does that have to do? Like, it has something to do with being, but it's not like this fundamental concept. Whatever is simple or meaningful or valuable or whatever is worth Bukowski putting it on the page for, it's not the same kind of, like, you know, in philosophy, we're trying to get to the rock bottom of what's really important. Obviously, Bukowski's putting this here because maybe at rock bottom it is important. It's like an early memory. It's an it's a semi-autobiographical book. So maybe that's why it's there. But again, we can't explain the simplicity in some kind of philosophical fundamental substance, right? I mean, the way that a person walks across the street hurriedly to avoid traffic, and we notice that as like a simple gesture of like metropolitan life or something like that. There's something that philosophers would gesture towards and say, like, wait, that was being. But I don't think that the poets or someone like Bukowski would want to. The thing is, I think this comes down to unfortunately, we're philosophers, we have to stick to what we have here. It comes down to a dichotomy between the particular and the general. I don't think that poets would ever generalize the simplicity of the things they see to some kind of like general phenomenon. They actually want to take seriously the simplicity of the particulars that they see, right? That's why they write poems of very particular things, and that's why they evoke very particular memories, and they talk not in grand cognitions or anything like that. They put something in front of themselves and think it's of value or want to articulate it.
I think that's largely correct, especially in good poetry. Have you ever read like a bad book?
Sure, yeah. I was gonna say, like, there are books that I don't particularly found that, like, I spent my time well reading them, and I would consider those, I don't know if I would consider those bad books, but like books that are either like frustrating or boring, maybe.
You know, I'm working on something really controversial here in my head. I'm going to put it out there. To me, good books, like good novels, I'm talking specifically about nonfiction or fiction here, sorry. The good novels capture something about life and the experience of life, the life world, as you mentioned earlier, that's very personal and relatable and feels real, for lack of a better way of saying it. I wish I had a better descriptor, and I'm trying to think of one.
The word that I have always used to describe this is that it's delicious. I don't know why I use that word, but whatever is being talked about is delicious. And I also use the metaphor of wading in it. I can wade out into it and spend time in it. And I feel like it's not just like, oh, you know, this is like a classic, I have to get it under my belt. Like actually reading like the episode of Odysseus going into the Cyclops cave, like I feel like it's almost like nutritious. It's delicious.
So, and I'm trying to articulate, and I actually really like that. I'm trying to articulate something kind of controversial here, which is I do not like the book Crime and Punishment. And one of the reasons I don't, as time's gone on, I've reflected on it more and more. Full disclosure, I've got like 90% of the way through and then put it down and then picked it back up. But you know, Crime and Punishment is a famous slog for many people. It's quite long. And one of the things I don't like about it, or the main reason I don't like it, is because it more or less follows the internal, the sort of mental ramblings of someone in a very specific, chaotic, psychological state. That for me, this is very personal. Like I'm not denying that Crime and Punishment is some important piece of literature or whatever. That it's not actually good. So I should preface with saying, like, have you read a bad book? I'm not saying that at all. But with the book Crime and Punishment, what I am saying is that it, for me, a book like that does not have that kind of milieu, that feel, that touch of like the actual, the real, the life world, because it is so focused on someone's internal analysis and monologue. And maybe in a sense it's that like second order, like it's like a being touched by or experiencing or encountering, for what it is, that analytic process, as but from the other position. And so maybe in that sense it's interesting, but for me I always found it to be very, there was something kind of hollow about the whole book. And I think that it's, like you said, it's like there's nothing to wade into. There's nothing that's like delicious about it. It's just it's continuous mental trauma.
It's like a psycho dialogue with itself or something. Yeah, no, I get that too. That was, so I was thinking in terms of, so I looked up, I do this and it's not a good habit, but I looked up a book review for Iris Murdoch's The Sea, and someone said it's like, you know, the diary of a narcissist gets old pretty quick. So I'm thinking maybe if something like that.
That's a much more eloquent way of putting it, right? Versus going back to something like Bukowski, which is I don't want to give the book away at all or anything, but you know, it's not exactly like a happy story. It's a rough recounting of a rough childhood, but it's also very, honest and intimate, warts and all, coming from the position of someone who doesn't think that they're, you know, the smartest person in the room all the time. You know what I mean? And the funny thing about that is the way that is usually displayed is by using not simple language, using not everyday language, right? Using not everyday phrasing and structuring or whatever, but instead being highly, you know, analytical and complex and descriptive and breaking things down in very, you know, articulate ways, and minute and articulate ways, which, you know, like happens basically is Crime and Punishment, you know, the I can't remember the main character's name, but it's basically what he's doing mentally the whole time. Versus someone who's just recounting very simply their simple, crappy childhood in a way that brings it to life far more, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, because I almost feel like my confession is worse than yours, that I haven't read Crime and Punishment. It's the frustrating thing, right? It's like, okay, well, could you write a good book that intention, like, okay, I'm a good author. I know that there's this like deliciousness that a great text invokes that a reader can really wade into it. I'm going to put some great metaphors down. You know, when the reader is put down the book, they can really chew on that and get some kind of meaning out of it. Well, if I was a good author, one avenue would be to subvert that and just write the most, like, you know, like, like a monological book ever. So I guess, and then like explore the possibilities in that. It would take a very charitable and patient reader, because usually, I don't know the reading audience of, like, you know, the early 20th century, but I am assuming that they were not, like, used to having to, like, basically read to someone's diary all the time. So this is the Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. You know how there are those memes where it's like, you know, how vivid is the apple in your head? Yeah, yeah. I was like, wow, okay, like, it's at a 10. This is a very vivid poem for me. When I, for whatever reason, the setting shows itself. There's hay bales. There's a sort of broken fence in the background. There's dirt all, you know, it's stamped out, but the edge of it is grassy. There's the chickens there. It's wet. It's such an evocative piece. It mentally throws up such a powerful image. It, how it contains its context and delivers all of this with these words is kind of the power of the poem. And it's, a lot of people have said, you know, this is quite mystical. There's quite a mystery here.
You know, I think that that's evocative, like, oftentimes with the mystery, like, that's the same way I felt a little bit about when I first read read that first opening line of Bukowski about being a child being under the table and being immersed in, or being amazed by, you know, the tablecloth and the table leg, but not the people, right? The people are not to be amazed by. I think that this kind of sense of wonder, and I got the same thing from that poem as well. It's a very, immediately there's this kind of, it's very evocative, almost kind of mystical. I can see the scene, right? Like, I feel, it's not even about seeing the scene. It's like, you can feel it, like you're there, and it's done far better than if we had like a multi-page description of some farm and how the farm works and all the people on the farm and what they do and why things are placed in certain. Yeah, exactly, right? And I think that they use the term mystical, and I think that is kind of a phrase that we sometimes use for a lot of this stuff when we're talking about the simple or the being or whatever it might be, in that it's one of those things that is the presence, its presence is obvious, it's felt, it's there, but the second you reach up to grasp it, you know, it starts to, you know, slide away, right? And so it always has this feel. It's very difficult. You know, it does make me think a little bit about, you know, even people like Heidegger, who, like, obviously kind, in some ways, like, devoted his life to that task and eventually kind of threw it out because he realized, you know, that, like, you know, the being in time, which, like, before Heidegger's famous work, for those of you listeners who don't know, something we've brought up many times on the show, you know, was ostensibly to get to the meaning of being. And it kind of, like, the work was unfinished because Heidegger just, like, realized that the project was not really completable, right? That there'd be some, on some level, there'd be, like, a contradiction in completing the project, particularly in a very analytic way, that something like Being Time is written and instead moved on to focusing far more on things like poetry as a vehicle to get to that space. I like the term background practices, which is, like, you know, we all have these ways of operating that we all do it, but it's, you know, Heidegger famously used the example, it's like having the glasses on your face, like, you see the world clearly, you understand, you operate through it, and the glasses are a part of that process, but you don't even notice they're there. And the only time you notice the glasses are there is if there's something wrong with them, or you start to take them off and look at them and all that, but then they're changed, right? Their whole being is changed, your relationship to them is changed, what's going on, the activity is totally different. And it'll never be the same. It'll never be an articulation of you wearing the glasses and operating in the world in a proficient manner, as all of us do in every sort of activity, right? You know, we wake up. I remember listening to a lecture a long time ago. And professor said, you know, what do you, like when you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing that you see? What's the first thing that you encounter, really, is the word. And is it, you know, your ceiling? Is it you open your eyes to the ceiling? Is it that you feel your bed? Is it all this kind of stuff? No, the answer is actually meaning. Like everything that you interact with is the entity, the being that it is, and has a particular relationship to you and your own life world and a certain kind of like meaning, but all that is totally immersive. And you can't like start, I can't start like, you know, picking at the wall to get the meaning out of there.
No, it's not. It's not like a material substance. It's a relation you have to.
It is a simple base relation going on that is so simple that articulation of it is so simple that the more you look at it, it gets very strange. But it is also, like we talked about this whole episode, and as we end, is that catch 22 of the second you try and articulate what it is in any like significant, you know, rational manner, some of that special sauce starts to sort of slip away.
Look at Bukowski and look at Williams. Paradoxically, they have found some way to evoke that special sauce using words. It's not analysis. It's not like an exhaustive list. And yet we can read this poem and, you know, a small farm scene flashes before our eyes, or we read Bukowski and we relate to an early memory. There is, again, paradoxically, language by circumventing or not saying what it wants to say somehow gets to what we want to say.
But I think that's, you know, with that said, we're out of time for today. So this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. You've been with Brandon and Hale. And we look forward to you listening next time. Thank you.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Your donation to CJSF supports a wider variety of voices and critical perspectives, context and content that corporate and mainstream media outlets don't cover, and new opportunities for community development and growth. Thank you for helping us rise higher and reach further.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
In Germany, people who want to go solar can simply go to the store, buy a solar panel, and plug it in at home. These plug-in solar systems send power directly into a home through a normal wall outlet.
Instead of taking electricity out of that outlet, it pushes electricity gently back into that outlet that powers the rest of your home.
Kevin Chu co-founded Brightsaber, a nonprofit that's working to increase access to plug-in solar in the U.S. He says plug-in solar systems do not produce as much energy as a full rooftop solar array, but they cost much less, can be installed on balconies or in yards with little or no expertise, and can be easily taken down and reinstalled if people move. So they're ideal for renters or low-income households.
The thing that resonated with me so much was the ability to take that first step within a couple of minutes and have that be an experience that's just like buying a TV or any other appliance.
In the U.S., a lack of regulatory and safety standards for the technology has prevented it from taking off. So Choose Group has been advocating for legislation to make plug-in solar more feasible and selling systems to early adopters to help people in the U.S., like those in Europe, enjoy this simple, low-cost form of clean energy.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication.
To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.